Are you looking to up your game in a manner never before seen? Then head over to Kickstarter to back Tabletop Artisans and their new project, the Adventurer's Kit. It's an all-encompassing gaming accessory designed to carry everything a player would need to play a tabletop RPG, and it doubles as a playing area. Visit tabletopartisans.com for more information, and visit them on Kickstarter to see for yourself. Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Today I'm speaking with Kimberly Lamb, who's worked primarily in play-by-post games, which are super interesting to me because I do not understand them at all, as well as some interesting hacks of existing systems. I heard her speak at a panel on historical LARP design at last year's Metatopia. She's working right now on a LARP about the intergenerational impact of the Cambodian genocide of the late 70s on her family, which for them is a living memory. I've linked to a documentary on the subject in the show notes, which I totally recommend you watch, but maybe with a supportive person nearby. Anyway, that's a small but very interesting part of our chat, and I thought you might want a heads up about it. Let's jump right in. Was this your first year doing the 200-word RPG challenge?
It was, yeah. I am very susceptible to peer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing about the 200-word RPG thing is that it's 200 words, right? So, I mean, right. You can rapidly find out if the game idea you have is too long or not going to work or whatever. And in fact, the first thing that I thought of did not work. It's like 1,000 words right now. And like, okay, well, never mind.
What is that thing?
Okay, so this actually has a little bit more of a backstory. A while back on my G+, I threw up a, I am bored, give me the name of an RPG that actually exists, and I will tell you what it's about. and I will make up what it's about, even if I actually know what it's about.
Right, right.
Which was fantastic. It was a lot of fun. I made up all sorts of ridiculous things. So one of the ideas, one of the titles that came up was Atlas Reckoning, and that's a game about, like, Mecca, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But I decided that it was about a committee of people who had, who was concerned about their colony AI, who was running the colony, because he seemed despondent. And so they decided the best thing to do would be to commission a girlfriend for him. And the whole game is about them talking about, like, this girlfriend.
Wow.
Just to make up for Atlas, the AI. So yeah, so for this RPG, it's essentially this committee, this committee of citizen colonists who have come together, and they're commissioning a new AI companion for their existing AI. And the committee is actually being recorded and run by the AI, and the AI is all like, oh no, don't worry, like, I'll just delete all this afterwards, I won't know anything, all of it will go to the human analysts and stuff, but like, you know, it's more efficient if I run these because I can run like 20 at a go. It's great. But during that thing, as everyone's talking about like different relationship things and answering these survey questions and stuff, the AI is trying to like practice forming connections with people.
Aww.
So, and at the end of the game, the AI has to decide, like the AI ends with a little speech like, oh, and of course I will be deleting these memories. And at that moment, the AI has to decide if they're lying and if they're going to actually keep these memories or delete them.
Wow.
Yeah, and anyways, that was like 1,000 words.
Well, yeah. So are you going to play test it? That sounds like a good LARP.
At some point, it's in really rough notes right now, and that sort of thing. But yeah, the making characters is super fast and easy because you pretty much just write down like characteristics of the best relationship you've ever had and characteristics of the worst relationship you've ever had in real life, and then you swap them with people, right? So you get like someone else's relationships, and then these are relationships that you used to have for your character. And then it's like this weird, like, you answer questions about, you know, what kind of relationship should this AI have with this new companion AI? And you're staring at your relationships you had in the past. And of course, that informs how you respond to these things, right?
Wow. That sounds really neat, actually. I'm like really excited to play that. Can you run that at the next Metatopia?
I can try. But yeah, so that's the one that didn't make it. Although notably, I think that one you could probably also run online as sort of like a sign into this online survey.
Oh yeah,
right. That's something I think about a lot. Because I don't make it out to a lot of cons. how to play in an asynchronous fashion or play online. Because there's a lot of barriers to online stuff. You aren't physically there. It's harder to read other people, technical issues, blah, 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 right?
That's interesting. So does that partially explain why you've written a handful of hacks for the Doomed Pilgrim in the Sundered Lands?
Yeah, so that's part of it. So I was utterly enamored when Vincent first put out Doomed Pilgrim. It was so neat, this whole, it didn't matter. You didn't have to stay for the whole game. You could sort of walk in, spit out a bit, and then like wander off and then come back. And the game progressed and it was interesting, right? And I mean, the moving parts of that game are very few. You need someone to sort of run the logistics of the game. Someone asks questions, someone answers questions. And then there's some sort of ending. But then I started thinking, okay, but who's asking the questions? What kind of questions do you ask? Can you split the party, as it were? At one point, Dimfna asked, why is it even competitive? Like, why is it framed competitively? Because it's not. And I went, oh my god, you're a genius! So I wrote, like, another game. Just to sort of explore that. And that one, I think, is one of my favorites. Atop a Lonely Tower.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let's break these down. Because what's interesting about the werewolf one, it's called Moonlight is Magic, right?
Yeah,
that's very cute.
I called it My Little Werewolf Moonlight is Magic, because why not?
No one can stop you. Right. So that's interesting, because then you sort of divide the players who sign up into two different factions.
Yeah.
Which, because this is like a play-by-post, all-in-one comment thread game, that's like, I'm trying to start a flame war voluntarily. I'm like, oh no, how does this happen?
Well, it's actually really interesting. So, it's obviously based on like the Werewolf of the Apocalypse sort of setting, because I needed a setting to hang this on just to see how it worked. So the idea is you choose one side, you know, guy or the worm, and the person running the game is playing the person about to change into the werewolf for the first time. So everybody, in order to subscribe to the thread, has to pick a faction, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the questions that get asked aren't like, does one faction win, does the other faction win, blah, 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 blah. They're just sort of basic questions, much like a Doomed Pilgrim game, generally. But the players have to sort of answer with their team in mind a little bit, right? Because they either want to recruit this werewolf for themselves or kill them, right, and deny the other team. So depending on what the situation is, they're like, well, can I use this to my advantage when I answer this question? Can I not? And that sort of thing. It adds sort of another layer of thinking. And it's not really strategy so much as just like, when can I slide in? Like, how are other people going to interpret my answers? Do I prefer letting this werewolf escape into the wild, or am I going to try to kill them to prevent them from joining one team or the other? It's really interesting. The gameplay itself doesn't change too terribly much from what I can tell, but my impression is that people are like just thinking a little bit more about the answers they're giving. Like, there's just this little extra layer. I'm not sure how much depth there is to that necessarily. But yeah, it was an interesting experiment just to see if you could split people into factions and how that would be affected. And I mean, it works. It works just fine. Although I think my favorite part of that game was the countdown timer thing. Because I didn't want to just decide when the change happened. That's boring. So there's some dice rolling in the background where every time something frightening or scary or unusual happens, which of course happens all the time because I'm asking questions to make people answer weird ways, I roll. And then there's a little chart that tells me how I respond to it. So I respond with either a fear response, a more rational response, or an anger response. Mm-hmm. And every time I roll, I add a cumulative +1 to my roll. And I'm rolling two dice because it's a Powered by the Apocalypse thing. So, of course, you're always rolling two dice. And when you hit, I think it was like, when you rolled a 14 or a 15, I think it was, that's when you did the change. So instead of looking at this thing of, do I have a fear response? Do I have a rational response? Do I have an anger response? It's just destroy everything, rip everything apart. And all of my responses at that point become that. And it's an interesting change in the dynamic, right? Because no one, including me, knows when this is going to happen. So it could happen at any time, depending on what people have set up and that sort of thing. And the end game, as it were, to be recruited to a side or to be killed off or to escape happens after the change. So,
right.
Yeah.
So That's interesting, because in Cleanse by Claw and Talon, which is about shapeshifters who are fighting these monsters that appear in their towns and they have to cleanse or destroy them, also has this inevitability thing going on, right? Where you're rolling, and for every time you've previously rolled for that, your end result increases by one. And so you can kind of subtly push towards something that you don't know when it's going to happen, but something like this is going to happen at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I lifted that countdown thing directly from Moonlight is Magic into Cleanse by Claw and Talon. The Skin Changers world is actually a world by Levi Cornelison. He's it's a game he's put out, which is essentially about animal spirits that have chosen people to become skin changers, and their only job is to fight bad guys, right? Abominations that exist. There are a couple of different ways of doing it, amongst which are cleansing or just destroying them, all of which are extremely dangerous and harrowing and terrifying and that sort of thing. And one thing that the Doom Pilgrim hacks are really good for is sort of providing a movie trailer for a game, right? You sort of pick a situation that is fraught with tension and that has sort of limited endings, as it were, and you can run through that situation.
Right.
So, I mean, that whole line of here's an abomination, go find it, go take care of it at the end, right? It lets you sort of explore the world a little bit, and it's very linear, it's very sort of short and clear. The game itself, of course, has, or rather the game Skin Changers itself has a lot more nuance, a lot more space. It's got shrines and talking with spirits, and forming groups and networks with other people, all that fun stuff, right?
It's very Sailor Moon, and it has this whole cleanse or destroy dilemma, you know, because Sailor Moon always wants to do moon healing escalation, right? But to the outer senshi, it's like, hey, just because you don't want to get your hands dirty, you know, people could really get hurt. That's still on you.
Yeah. I've played Skin Changers itself, and I really like it because it does have that dilemma. The extent to which you want to care about humans, like, is sort of the thing, right? Like, at some point, you have to recognize that your job of getting rid of the abominations is it. So what are you going to do? And how much work are you going to do it? There's a game we played where we could, like, call the phone tree and get people to come down, right? But they were like, well, who do you want us to send on this? And we were like, oh man, we could get all the big hitters and just kill everyone, sort of thing, or we could try and find out who the one big bad is who's running the show and cleanse that person, and then maybe clear everything else out, right? Maybe that'll work. We ended up going in that route in part because our characters were young and weren't very, like, fighty or anything along those lines, and we wanted to act according to our strengths rather than just destroying everything. And part of that undoubtedly is also my personal preferences. I'm always doing the whole, like, well, okay, it would totally be easier just to punch them in the face and be done with it. Or I could invite them over for tea and we could be uncomfortable for 3 hours while I talk about their moral choices. That sounds like a great idea. Which is inevitably what I play. So I like games with dilemmas in them. I like games that are a little bit more uncomfortable, that have that tension, that have the not so clear choice, right?
Okay, we will come back to that. Quick last question about your Doomed Pilgrim hacks. You talk about Journey's End in a Frozen Wasteland as being, like, incredibly, like, creepy and sad. And why? Why is it so creepy and sad and brutal? What happened in there?
Okay, so as the GM, you can ask whatever questions you feel like. And the premise of the game is that you're this ghost, you're in the Frozen Wastelands, and you sort of see something that sparks some memories, right? And you're trying to move on and pass on to the other realm instead of lingering as a ghost. That's what I'm trying to do. That's what my character is trying to do. And the problem is that I'm constantly being inundated with memories that just keep popping up, right? I can ask whatever I want to fill out the details, which is normal. The other players can only ask two questions. One, do you remember something? The other question is that really true?
Ooh.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they could ask anything. Do you remember your grandfather's death. Do you remember this, that, and the other thing? And the answer is always, like, if I remember correctly, the instructions on my end is, the answer is always, of course I remember. And then you fill in some details.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. The setting is such that there was a war happening and you presumably died in the war or whatever. Anyways, during one of my playtests, someone, I think it was Dimfin again. Gosh, she asked the best questions. She asked, do you remember the feel of the gun barrel in your mouth?
Whoa.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa, okay. I guess that's where we're going with this. And yeah, I wrote this thing about remembering the taste of the barrel in my mouth and my fear and something. And then someone asked, is that really true? Wow. And I'm like, oh my God, I guess not. Okay. There's something more. All right. Let's see how this goes. That was a really interesting game because it puts a lot of the creative onus on the person running the game, right? It's very disjointed. It's kind of all over the place. It's a lot more work for the person running the game. But yeah, because the backdrop is one of war, is one of death and of like weird choices and bad choices and trying to do good and all this other stuff. Every time people ask about like disjointed memories, trying to tie them all together just makes everything creepier and sadder as you go.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of how it played out. I don't know if it would always play out that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, theoretically, you could have a different sort of backdrop and maybe it would change. But yeah, that one turned out to be really fantastic and creepy and just so sad. This person who had gone to war, like, all proud and noble and stuff and, like, remembers cannibalism and, like, an almost suicide and killing someone, and it's a little bit fuzzy whether or not the death was, like, deserved or not, or if it was over food or what. Yeah.
Dang.
Right? But yeah, those two questions, do you remember something, and the instructions to sort of answer those questions in a sort of particular way, plus is that really true, just adds up to all sorts of wacky.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, these are all extremely enticing and potentially pretty accessible, right? Because even people who don't necessarily have a regular home group can theoretically play them with folks they know online. All of us have more online friends than IRL friends now, right? That's normal?
I think so.
Yeah, I think
so. Yeah,
we're all...
I think so.
Okay, good.
It's,
yeah.
It's true.
Where can people find these? Is this are all of these that we've been talking about things I can direct my listeners to?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so Atop a Lonely Tower is Pay What You Will on Drive-Thru. The others are just like half-finished Google Docs hanging out in my design folder. I'm so sorry. partly because... When I run playtests, I usually don't have anything resembling a finished game, which, okay, is true of a lot of people, right? But usually when I run a playtest, I'm testing a very specific thing. Like, I've written up to a point, and I'm like, I feel like something's missing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll throw some players at it, and maybe something will happen. So one of the things I discovered in Frozen Wasteland is the idea that your responses sort of work best if they have a particular, like, theme or mood or whatever, mm-hmm. right? And I don't think I've ever explicitly written that anywhere. and Atop a Lonely Tower actually suffers from that a little bit too, right? Like, because the whole like reach an end game bit in that is essentially when it feels like the story has hit a point where you should find an ending, go find one. So yeah, that's the only one that's actually available easily. The other ones, like if people want to bug me and be like, hey, can you show me what you have for this? I'm certainly happy to.
Mm-hmm. You keep a little pretty low profile, Kim.
I do. Yeah. It's not exactly on purpose, but I don't have a particularly strong like urge to be self-promote-y either.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't really make RPG products, right? I do game design, I do hacks and that sort of thing, but I don't make products.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
If I were making products, then promotion and self-promotion would be a big deal.
Yeah.
But since I don't, then it's like, I figured out this little puzzle. Fantastic. I'm done.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be my question, right? Like, what is the satisfying part of doing design for you, if not, you know, making the shiny thing that goes out into the world?
Well, just making the shiny thing is a lot of fun in and of itself, right? I do origami a lot, and I'm not that good at it.
I've seen the pictures. I'm going to do a little quiet disagree. But carry on.
Well, I like to think that my simple pieces are fairly elegant. But Yeah, like it's really satisfying just to do it, to figure out a difficult diagram, to figure out that weird like fold that didn't make sense, and you had to watch 5 videos on slow-mo just to figure out, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have this lovely little piece, and it's done, and that's it, right? Like, and then you move on to sort of the next thing. And I feel that way a lot about game design too. I like fiddling around with things. I like going, oh well. If a game is written like this, these are clearly design choices that the designer made. What happens if I tweak something or I change something? Does everything fall apart? Does it have interesting results afterwards? I mean, one of the great things about the Doom Pilgrim hacks is that it's super easy to test, right? Like, I don't have to stick around for all day. I don't have to gather anyone. I just throw up a post and wander off and come back every once in a while. And just kind of see how people, like, respond. It's fantastic. Like, and that let me test a gazillion different iterations of Doom Pilgrim. Yeah, so that's kind of how I feel about just game design in general, just putting something together and looking at it and going, ah, yes, that does seem to click together well. Fantastic. Now I'm going to go have a sandwich.
That's called work-life balance right there.
Well, and I mean, I'm sure everyone who like discovers the online design community is suddenly like, and I too could be a star. And many people are really happy being stars, and many people are stars and realize they're not happy. And I realized that I didn't want to be a star, right? Like, I just kind of wanted to do my thing, and it's nice.
Yeah, and I mean, you're talking about finding satisfaction in the process rather than the product, right? In the doing rather than the thing that is done.
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, I really like doing the origami, but then I have all these like paper things floating around and they take up a lot of space, and like, but I'm done with it now. So what do I do? Which is why I give it all away. I'm like, here, have a paper thing. And everyone's always so delighted, right? Because they're cute and fun. And I'm like, that's great. I'm glad you're happy with it. Now it's not taking up space on my shelf and I can make another one. Yay.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So speaking of you having your fingers in a lot of pies, I'm really, really interested to know, what was the Misspent Youth world that you were working on?
So I actually don't have a world, I have a hack.
Oh, even more fascinating.
Okay, so funny thing, it turns out, okay, a lot of people love making worlds and NPCs and all this stuff and all that fiction stuff, and I think that's great. I am not good at this. I get very bored doing that world building stuff without someone else to bounce ideas off of, and without having someone else to give me emotional feedback on something, right? So, like, I mean, Rob emailed me or hit me on G+ or whatever and was like, hey, do you want to do a world for this? I'm like, oh, well, I don't really have your game text. It sounds interesting. He's like, well, here, have the game text. I'm like, oh, well, okay, I'll read it then, sure. And he's like, and I mean, if you have another idea like a hack, you should just let me know and we'll see. I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. So I'm flipping through the game. And I'm like, oh, let's think about worlds. And I love turning things on their heads. So, I mean, Misspent Youth, the word, one of the keywords there is youth, right? So I was thinking, God, you know what would be a fun world is if it was like an old folks home. It was a bunch of old people who had to like overthrow their like in like the people caring for them because like they'd all been forgotten. That'd be fantastic. Screw you, youth. And not that long ago, I had rewatched Red, which is a movie about a bunch of like old CIA agents or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they realize they're being hunted. So they come back and they're all badass and stuff. And Helen Mirren is a sniper and she's the best person ever. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so I was like, oh, well, what about a game where you were a youthful offender and you came back after everything had gone to shit again? So, you know how in Misspent Youth there's this thing called, what are they, convictions, I think. And they start off very, like, innocent and cool and awesome, and then they become, like, you sell out, and they become sold out, and everything's horrible, and they're, like, sort of the dark, like, gritty, bad versions of
right, of the, right, whatever. Yeah, so, like, smart becomes pedantic, and...
Right, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, this is what I do. I'm like, well, what happens if? Like, it only goes in one way in Misspent Youth. So I'm like, well, what if you start backwards? What if you start off with the horrible one and you can reclaim your youthful innocence, your soul again?
Wow, cool. So you can go from, you know, vengeful to righteous or whatever
it is. So my hack is called Youth is Wasted on the Young. Yeah, so that's the hack. The idea is that you used to be a youthful offender and you won.
Hmm.
You got your utopia or whatever the hell that was, and but in the process you were hurt really badly, and over the years you become hurt more, this sort of thing. But that was fine because you won, you retired, whatever. And then things go to hell again. Your dream becomes a broken dream, and you have to you've decided to be like, screw this noise, I'm not letting this happen to my dream. So you get the old clique back together again, or the clique, and you go off and you try and solve this. And in that process, you can actually sort of buy back your soul, as it were, right? You can choose to be all dark and gritty and be the shit out of things, or you can choose to take a sort of better path, a path that you used to remember doing, but that you'd given up on ever achieving again. And yeah, that's the game.
That sounds really fun.
Yeah. Also, super easy to playtest because all the rules on how to do conflicts and that sort of thing are exactly the same. So since it works in the original game, I didn't have to test to see if it worked in the new hack.
Well, so that's one of the advantages of hacking, right? Which is something that I know is very appealing to you. Let me think, actually. So you're working on this LARP now called Blood is Thick. Is this the first project that you've worked on that wasn't in some way like a hack of an existing thing?
Sort of. Yeah. Like, I mean, I steal from a lot of places and a lot of things. But yeah, this is definitely one that isn't built on the framework of another game, which is why it's hard, because this is not a skill set that I practice extensively. In an established game, everything sort of has already been tested and fits together, and you can sort of see where the boundaries are and how things are likely to work and that sort of thing, and you can cross-compare it to other games and that sort of thing. So when you change something, you have a reasonable expectation of kind of how it goes. Whereas with this, I'm like, well, I can do anything with it. Oh God, choices. What? Choices are hard. And I mean, Blood is Thick is also kind of personal to me in ways that I never expected.
Really?
So... yeah. So for your listeners who have no idea what Blood is Thick is, it's essentially about a family living with the aftermath of the Cambodian genocide. And I was going to take this family and set it in Cambodia during the Vietnamese occupation, because there's some really good, there's some really interesting tensions there about for Cambodians who ended up like suffering horribly under the Khmer Rouge, but then becoming complicit with the Vietnamese government that was installed, that essentially just took all of the natural resources out of Cambodia and all the civil war fighting and all this other stuff, right? Like there's a lot of different layers of stuff that was happening. And I was trying to figure out how to do this game in such a way that I wouldn't be like completely glossing over the Cambodian lifestyle and their culture and everything, while at the same time being accessible to sort of a Western audience, because let's be real, that's who I'm writing for, right? Because I live in the West. And so I'm struggling with this, and I'm reading all of these memoirs of people who went through like the work camps and who lived through the famines and who had family members die and all this other stuff. And I realized that I couldn't put it in Cambodia because I don't actually have the information to write that. I think I have to put it as an immigrant family, right? And so there's this juxtaposition between like sort of the Western world, their current culture, and then also wanting to preserve your culture, but at the same time recognizing that one of the things that came out of your culture, or one of the experiences that came out of your homeland, was deep trauma.
Yeah.
That was perpetuated by your own family on itself. And my family is Chinese, not Cambodian, but my family actually comes from Cambodia. My mother's family is sort of quintessentially capitalist scum, as it were, right? Like my grandfather had a Coca-Cola factory, and also produced 7-Up, which is a Pepsi product.
Wow.
And somehow he managed to get both. Like, I don't even know. Everyone was very proud of him. And he provided soda pop for the entire country, right? It was very common to kill off the Chinese because they were likely to be businessmen, or they were sus- suspected of being businessmen, right?
Right. They were associated with that
class. And it's an interesting juxtaposition because on the one hand, you're killing off Chinese people because they might have been involved in business, but at the same time, they're courting the Chinese communists because at least they aren't Russian communists. And the Russian communists are backing the Vietnamese and we don't like those filthy Vietnamese, right? Like that's sort of the thinking. But at the same time, we're just going to kill everyone.
Right. Yeah, ultimately.
Right. It was a complete mess overall. So my family is an immigrant family. I have relatives that have died or have gone through this thing. And I realized, oh God, I'm actually writing an immigrant story, which is kind of like me. And one of the characters in the game was actually a baby during the genocide. So it doesn't remember anything except for sort of like just sense memories sort of thing. And is trying to sort of assimilate or grow up into a new world while at the same time trying to figure out why her mother and her aunt and her grandmother and stuff have all of this trauma and how it affects their relationships and that sort of thing, which in many ways is kind of how I interact with my family because I was born here.
Right.
And now I'm like, oh God, when did this become like semi-autobiographical? I don't like feelings. What the hell? So yeah, it's been an interesting journey working on this game.
And I'd really like to ask you about your research process because there is an incredibly complex, you know, historical political situation. And then there is talking to your family about this kind of stuff. And I'm assuming that you're doing a lot of both.
Yeah. So I, some of it was just like looking at the history of it. It's a mess. Let's be real. The political situation in Cambodia or in even just Southeast Asia at the time was messed up because, it was during the Cold War, and Russia and the U.S. didn't really want to fight actual wars with each other, so they just got other people to fight wars for them. So these so-called proxy wars aren't actually proxy for the people who are fighting them. They're just fighting, right, and dying, and it's kind of horrible. So there's a lot of, like, political layers and that sort of thing. But sort of on the ground level, no one really cares what the political ramifications are of the U.S. bombing the Cambodian-Vietnamese border. They just care that bombs are falling.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And no one cares that it's the U.S. unless you happen to work for the U.S. And then it's like, well, okay, if the U.S. doesn't, like, win or keep up or whatever, then my neighbors are going to kill me. So that sucks. So yeah, there's like a lot of those layers which are really easy to get lost in, right? Like there's so much maneuvering and stuff on the international level and a lot of like the politics that are going on and the propaganda that's floating around and that sort of thing. So I got lost in that for a while, which was fun times. And also concurrently, I looked into a lot of memoirs and things. One of the first ones, I actually watched a documentary called S21. And it is by one of the survivors of the genocide, and it is about S21, which was one of the death prisons. So the idea is with those is that you would get sent there, you would be tortured until you confessed to your crimes, and then you would die. And apparently it was a really big deal to get your story out, get the proper documentation. To demonstrate that you were in fact a traitor or horrible or whatever and deserved to die, that you had committed a crime. But what was really interesting about this particular documentary was that it involved two of the few survivors of the prison interviewing former guards.
Whoa.
Right. And what's really interesting is the age difference between them, because the guards look like they're in their 30s or so, and you find out that the guards were like 12 to 14.
Yeah.
When they were doing these sorts of things. And it's this really, like, heartbreaking documentary to watch because, I mean, they do these interviews. They're at the site of S21, and the guards actually pantomime things that happened there, right? And one of the things that struck me was that whenever they were asked, well, why did you do it? How? What were you thinking? And this sort of thing, the guards always had the same answer. I was afraid for my life. I had to do it. If I didn't, I would die. They would kill me. I did these horrible things. And, I mean, the former prisoners were like, okay, yeah, but, I mean, you did these horrible things to people. You killed people, you tortured them, you interrogated them, this sort of thing. Like, what's up with that? And the guards would just keep saying over and over again, we had to, or else we would have died, right? That's the only story that they're really allowed.
Right.
And there's this line, someone said something about, I think one of the guards said something about not having any humanity, about having their humanity taken away, right? Of not being allowed to be human in that time. Even though they sort of recognized it in their heads that this was wrong, they still had to do it. And the prisoner responded, or the former prisoner responded with, well, you took away our humanity by killing us, by torturing us, and this sort of thing. So no one was human at all. And I was thinking, God, how do you handle that? How do you go from having everything be so horrible and terrible and whatever that you sort of stop being human and you just sort of function as an organism?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when you reclaim your humanity again? Right? Like, how do you bear that weight? And one of the things I discovered while playtesting this game at Metatopia was that I was trying to follow sort of the traditional arc, right? So exposition, rising, tension, climax, denouement. And I realized in this game that that is not the point. The point of this game is to have sort of an even level of tension throughout and then realize the depth of it as you go. It's not about like having a climax and then being able to let go. It's just a realization of the weight that you are bearing and never being able to put it down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of where memoirs and stuff got me. I mean, thankfully my parents were not in the country at the time. They were abroad studying and that sort of thing. Although I certainly lost aunts and uncles and stuff. And I've spoken with aunts who have done things like boiled wood in water until it was soft enough to eat so that you would have something in your stomach. They've talked about like mines around banana trees so that you couldn't, you know, pick the bananas. Having to leave your kids to guard the baby in search for food, like the escape, all that fun stuff. And even that stuff is like heartbreaking because it's not like the international community went like, oh no, there is a genocide, we should help. It's, I mean, to a certain extent there was that, but there's also stuff like, ha, we've made it to the Thai border. Oh, they are turning us back and sending us through minefields back into our country. That sounds great.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I mean, and then I talk to my parents, right? They talk about their family members. They talk about their lives in Cambodia before the war and that sort of thing, which is really fascinating because, I mean, the dialogue for those foreign parts is either it's the ancient Cambodia with all the temples and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's war-torn Cambodia with all the mines and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
For my dad, he was the disco king of Phnom Penh, and he loves telling the story about how he'd walk down the street and people would be like, you should come to my party, and he'd be like, well, okay, but do you have a live band, and how many people are there, and are they a good band, because I don't go to just any party. Like, that's the life that they remember, right? And it had, like, disco and hippies and movies and that sort of thing. So, yeah, you don't really get that in the West. That's not part of the story and stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. So. Right. And that's true of a lot of places in Southeast Asia where the Western narrative of those places begins at when it got messed up really, really, really bad. And so people don't have a sense of what was lost if they know anything about it at all. My next question is, when you're making a game about something this profoundly difficult, what are your goals? What do you want players to walk away with?
In the case of Blood is Thick, I want people to walk away with the idea that just because the events have passed doesn't mean that you stop carrying the weight of them, right? Like, the way that the genocide affected families and things changed a lot. Like, there are a lot of Cambodian immigrants. And how they assimilate into a new culture, how they maintain their former culture, all that stuff is a thing. Not too long ago, I saw an article about how one of the symptoms of the trauma is that these Cambodian women were going blind when they were super stressed out about stuff. If they were like dwelling in the memories and this sort of thing, they would stop being able to see properly. And once they went into therapy sessions and that sort of thing, their vision improved. And we don't really think about that sort of thing. And what's really important for me to sort of get through is the idea that it's not, oh, they did this to us. It's we did this to each other. And to be fair, we did this to each other because we were trying to survive, because we thought it was the right thing, because we had no other choices. But even in those situations where we didn't have a choice, we were just trying to survive, you still did those things. And you still have to live with it.
It sounds like there's something that you're trying to impart to people that is more than just historical facts.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, okay. I have a lot of interest in and no good answers for what we do with our abusers as a community, as individuals, as that sort of thing, right? Because if you look at the data, a lot of abuse victims become abusers. But how do we deal with abusers? Well, we exile them, right? Mm-hmm. They're not our problem anymore. We identify them and we exile them, the end. And we know very well, we know that exile is a big fucking deal. Because we are very reluctant to exile anyone without like the hugest amounts of proof and that sort of thing, right? Like this crops up all the time in like conventions and other things. It's like, oh, this person is a harasser. Are you sure? Are they really? Because we're friends. So are they? Right. So, I mean, we understand that exile is horrible, which is why we do it to abusers.
Mm-hmm.
But then what? Like it's not like we shoot them out an airlock and they disappear forever. Right? Like they're still alive and in the world and in communities and stuff.
Exactly. They go to other communities where people don't know them as well.
Right. But I mean, that doesn't solve the problem of an abuser, right? And what if you're an abuser? Yeah, what if you realize, oh God, I've done abusive things. What do I do? What resources do I have to become better? How do I make amends? How do I reintegrate into a community that may or may not want me? How do I demonstrate that I'm good to reintegrate? The narrative of, oh, abusers are just bad guys, let's exile them, means that they're not our problem anymore. We would like abusers not to be a problem, but we don't actually want to solve the problem of them.
Right.
And like I said, I don't have any good answers for this one at all, because it's always like, well, okay, on the personal level, obviously, set your boundaries. No particular person is required to help any other particular person, especially if they've been abusive and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
Like, education is not free. But okay, then what?
Yeah.
Right. Like, and if I've decided that I want to help out my friend who has done horrible things, and I do that, that's going to affect how people interact with me, because all I see is me interacting with someone who's been abusive,
mm-hmm.
right? And who wants to change their ways and that sort of thing. So, what I'm trying to get at in this particular game is that, like, it's not just so much that no one is innocent, but more like, well, being an abuser is a burden that you carry. Having done horrible things is a burden that you carry. Now what?
Yeah. Because obviously they have to acknowledge that whatever they did it and it was horrible and take ownership of it. But then what happens after that? Like, literally, what is step two? I think a lot of people have no idea.
Well, exactly, right? Like, and even when, like, we think back to personal things that we've done that are horrible, right? You're filled with shame and embarrassment and like, oh God, how do I make amends? And then you're like, well, how do I make amends? Like, how do I have that conversation? And I mean, sometimes it works out. You have that one-on-one conversation with someone. You go, hey, I did this horrible thing to you, and I know you've never brought it up, but I just want to bring it up to you and say that that wasn't okay. And they go, oh, well, you know what? I didn't even notice. It's fine. And you sit there going, I still feel like shit, and I don't know what to do now. Because you've absolved me, and we're taught, let's ask for forgiveness, and when they forgive you, it's all over. But that's not true. Like, setting aside even the societal pressure of forgiving people when they ask for forgiveness, because apparently the act of asking is good enough.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So then what? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think my game is going to give anyone any answers on that either. But I think what I'm aiming for is that you sort of feel that weight and you realize you still have to sort of carry on. You still have to make decisions. You still have to do the best you can with what you've got. And you can sort of choose how that looks and whether or not it eases some of that burden as you go along.
There's got to be some like critical number of people thinking about a question, you know, before someone comes up with decent potential answers.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no universal answer to this either, obviously, right? Like that's the problem. It's, well, something that someone does to me might not actually bother me too terribly much, but they might think, oh my God, I'm the worst person ever because I've done this thing. And then you have to kind of handle that. And someone else on the outside is watching this and is like, oh my God, what have you done? And then there's the whole, oh, it wasn't that bad.
Right.
And yeah, like I said, we have like no good answers for this. We're starting to have some answers for victims and survivors. We really don't have good answers for abusers.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's bright and sunny where I am, so I'm just like, la la la, depressing stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what my last question is. Okay. When are we going to get to see the LARP about trees that want to hook up? You know, where you have some trees and the ones with the birds and the bees. Look, I read your G+ profile, okay? You have to answer to this stuff.
the not-so-secret sex lives of trees. Oh, gosh, I don't even know. So I sort of poke at this every once in a while, right? Because I'm like, because I really love the idea of it, right? Like, your trees, you can't move, but you want to hook up, so you have to get the birds and the bees to help you. So it's this, like, weird note-passing thing, essentially. It's kind of like high school or junior high, where you get, like, your best friend to send a note to your crush and is like, hey, would you, like, go out with me sort of thing? Mm-hmm. Except with birds and bees and whatever. Mm-hmm. Gosh, I don't know. That's sort of like this joke project that I made up and then realized it might actually go somewhere. And like I said, I'm much better at hacking than I am at sort of coming up with things as a whole sort of stuff, right? Because there's so many choices. So one of my ideas is to just sort of loosely base everyone off of Shakespeare, like Shakespearean characters, and build the characters like that and the connections like that and just sort of let it go and see what happens. Like, I don't know.
Well, you know what? Just make it. And then if it's not very good, you can hack it into something amazing, right?
Yeah. I really should. I should just do, like, maybe a 10-player game, just kind of see how it goes with, like, three trees and a bunch of, like birds and that sort of thing. My idea is that I want the birds to only be able to speak in, like, a regular tone of voice or yelling. And I want the trees to be able to speak in a normal tone of voice and the bees can only whisper.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It would be like, hey, can you tell that willow over there that I like her leaves? And then your body's like, hey, willow! Like, no, no, oh God, no!
Should have told bee. Should never send a bird to do a bee work. God, or maybe, like, terrible. Bees can speak, but only at really low volumes, as where, like, birds can be really loud, but they have to, like, play a flute and can't actually say words.
Right? Like, there's so many different, like, wacky possibilities to do with this sort of thing, right?
And then trees wouldn't be able to talk at all. They just have to, like, move and, like, interpret interpretive dance their ideas.
Right? Yeah. Oh, God. Right, there's all sorts of things. Or bees could carry notes, sort of like pollen, and they're like...
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yeah, and you could send notes. Like, there's 50,000 different configurations of how to do it. Someone listening to this podcast needs to write this game so I don't have to. This one needs to happen. I promise to play test it. So someone write this.
Yes, I also make this pledge. If you make the tree love game, I will play it. It will happen.
Yeah.
We'll make something.
The not-so-secret sex lives of trees.
Just, a very silly lark.
Yeah, it's exceptionally silly. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't know when that's going to happen. One of the nice things about being, like, just doing it for funsies is that I don't have deadlines if I don't want them.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Right? So it's like, when I feel like working on this project.
It'll happen when it happens.
It'll happen. Which is probably why Blood is Thick is taking so long, part of it. And part of it is like, I have to confront my own feelings about my self-identity. It's hard.
Yeah, that's like a lot of, I would not want to have a deadline on that particular project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mo's been actually really, really good about that. She's just been like, so how's it going? Doing good? Okay.
That's right, because it's going to be released as a Warbirds game.
As a Warbirds. It's like a Warbirds auxiliary thing, because it's not like out of World War anything necessarily, unless you want to follow like the whole after World War II.
Certainly there's a lot of connections to
blah blah blah
reality.
Yeah blah blah Cold War, blah blah French colonists, blah blah, you know.
Is there anything else in the hopper? Is there anything else going on that you're excited about or that you're working on that you want to share with people?
Oh, I was a finalist for the 200 word RPG.
Oh yeah, that's right, heck, we didn't even talk about that. Okay. Give the lowdown in less than 200 words.
Oh, God. The land is full of demons and you play warriors and you fight with haiku.
Yes. Yes. Haiku game.
That's the game. Yeah. So, okay. So after the first game that I wrote didn't pan out because it was way too long.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, well, that's fine. Moving on with my life. And Jax Brick bugged me about writing a thing. And I'm like, I don't have a thing to write. And she's like, you will do a thing. I'm like, oh. And I'm out having ramen with some friends, right? And I'm whining to them about how, oh, 200 words is hard. I don't, my ideas are too long and it takes work and the soup is great. Anyways, and my friend Albert was like, you should write it in haiku. I'm like, excuse me? He's like, just write it in haiku. Then you, it's super easy, right? Because it's like, you know, do like 20-ish haikus. Do the whole thing in haiku. It'll be great. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a ridiculous challenge, which means it's the sort of thing I enjoy. Whoops. Like, whoops. So I didn't actually write the whole thing in haiku, although notably, there is one of the finalists. It got there's a game written in Renga. So it's like haiku and waki. Oh. So it's like 575 and then 77. And the whole thing is written in that. It's fantastic.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, well, let's write haikus. What are haikus good for? Describing things. All right, well, we're warriors and we're fighting demons. And I'm like, well, okay, I don't want to like put dice or anything in this. I just want this to be haiku writing, but I don't want people to have to judge each other's haikus. Mm-hmm. That's a pain in the butt. So I put in the prisoner's dilemma.
There you go.
Right? Because that's easy. So yeah, the point of the game is it's GM-less. Everybody has a warrior. And there are two focal characters per scene. Everyone else sort of puts together the challenge of the scene. And then the two focal characters secretly write haikus. And in their haikus, they either help each other and work together to defeat the challenge, or they, like, sabotage each other. And then it's revealed, like, what you've done, right? So if everyone works together, the challenge is defeated, and it's great and dandy. And if one person sabotages the other one, then they defeat the challenge and everything's dandy and whatever. And in the last one, if they sabotage each other, the challenge is undefeated and they have to write shame haiku. Right. And every time these things happen, you cross off a line in one of your like original haikus that you wrote about your warrior. And then once all of those are crossed out, you die. And you can either write a haiku about your glorious death. Or you can write a demon-inspired, spiteful haiku. Ooh. And cross off lines in other people's haikus.
Oh.
So it's like, wait, you've all sabotaged me? Screw you all. Here's my spiteful haiku. Cross off your lines. And then the game ends when there's only like one person standing or everyone's dead. Like,
wow, dang. That sounds really fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of cute. I'm actually a little sad because I was kind of hoping that I could work in a final showdown with the demon king or whatever, where like maybe if you were the first one down, you were possessed by the demon king and rose again as the final challenge or whatever. But anyways, I have scratch notes for a deluxe version.
Ooh, a 400 word.
I know, it's very exciting.
Well, by the time this comes out, you will probably have won, so congratulations. 200 word RPG challenge.
There are so many fantastic things on
there's
there.
There's a lot of good ass games that get made for that thing.
Oh, I don't know if you read Feast.
No, I haven't.
My heart. Okay, so Feast, I don't remember who wrote it, but it's all the players bring food, and it's already my favorite game because it has food in it. And every person brings like bite-sized morsels of food that have a particular flavor, so bitter, sweet, whatever, right? And everyone brings enough for everyone to have a bite. The idea is that everyone's playing an entity that consumes a person. And so every round, it's a specific like phase, so like when the person was first infected or whatever, right? You take a bite of something, and then you narrate a memory and stuff that you've consumed. And what you narrate is based off of what you've eaten. So if you eat something bitter, it's like a regret or whatever, right? And that's the game. The whole thing is narrating this person's life. And then once you've eaten all the food, they're gone.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah, that's really cool.
Right? It's amazing. Oh, or like Muscle Marines. It makes me laugh so hard. It is what it sounds like.
Okay. You're
Muscle Marines in space. Ooh. And so to figure out conflicts, you arm wrestle each other. Loser has to do push-ups.
Aww.
It's pretty fantastic. I kind of love it. Yeah, so there's like so many fantastic, awesome games in there. It's so cool. And like I said, there's another one that has like Renga in it, which is great. Mm-hmm. So high five Poetry Brigade.
Okay, beautiful. Well, everyone will go and check that out then. And I'm excited to see the winners, but all the finalists and really like just every entry I've seen people posting about it and stuff has just been lovely. So I'm really glad. Okay, well, we should probably wrap things up, but like, yeah, if people want to catch up with you, where should they go?
I'm on G+. Mm-hmm. Mostly I've been posting in circles lately though, but just ping me and I'm happy to add you. But yeah, that's where I post most of my stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm always open to being pinged and having conversations about things.
Okay, cool. Well, it was totally awesome having you. This was a really good chat.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
Ooh, my pleasure.
Well, huge thanks to Kim for joining us. And as always, thank you for listening. Remember that if you want to get in touch, you can email me, thatsbackstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at me, @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows like Campaign, One Shot, Talking Tabletop, and Modifier at oneshotpodcast.com. If you haven't been keeping up with Campaign, they finally got off Fendar. It's a good time to start listening. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.